Sometimes you have the right skills, but you're in the wrong place. Imagine if Keith Moon had been in REM, or your mom had been in REM for that matter. Imagine Orson Welles in an MGM musical. These are all great things that don't necessarily go well together. What if you're the right dreamer, but you're in the wrong dream? In the years between Bucky Dent and Derek Jeter, the Yankees had a hell of a time finding a shortstop who could play regularly or at all. They traded for Roy Smalley, who had a good bat for a middle infielder back then, but he had a bad back and couldn't play the position anymore. Andre Robertson looked like a good glove. I'm not sure if he really would have hit on a long-term basis, but regardless, he got into a bad car accident that pretty much terminated his career. Bobby Meacham was error-prone, didn't hit consistently, and had been singled out by George Steinbrenner for destruction. One guy that they tried in this period was Wayne Tolleson. Wayne came over in a six-player trade with the White Sox, which also saw the Yankees get Ron Kittle and Joel Skinner. Wayne was appealing. He wasn't incredibly talented, but he would hustle, grind out at bats, try to steal the odd base, though rarely at a great rate, and was good on defense. He was fun in the way only a player who compensates for being 5'9 and needing to wear big glasses with grit and a heavy mustache can be. He had hit a kind of fluke 313 with the Rangers in 1985, and that must have convinced somebody with the Yankees that he was an all-around two-way shortstop, but it wasn't true. He was more of a 240 guy at best. And so when he came to the Yankees and reverted to form, in short order, they were ready to move on and try another shortstop. That turned out to be the immortal Alvaro Espinoza. He of the killer 224, 258, 274 triple slash stats in 1990. Wayne was somehow still on the roster then, 4 years later, but the Yankees had no clue what to do with him. If there's a 25th man, a guy who the manager only breaks in case of emergency, Wayne was 25.5. It wasn't that he was hurt or in the minors or anything like that, he just rarely played. He appeared in 73 games, but was only given 83 plate appearances, and could disappear for a week without anyone bothering to file a missing persons report. My friends and I, who followed the Yankees closely, tended to notice this, especially with Espinoza being so miserable that even Tolleson would probably have been better. One day, my friend Andy and I went to a game and arrived early, and moved down to field level to take in batting practice. As we leaned on the rail, Wayne Tolleson strolled onto the field a short distance away from us. I really don't remember which of us shouted this out loud, but one of us said, "Hey Wayne, what are you doing here?" And without missing a beat, without even looking up, Wayne shouted back, "I don't know." Right dreamer, wrong dream. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. There. The journey on the ice floe with the hideous but strangely articulate creature has come to a surprisingly good end, and you find yourself in episode 6. Although it's spring, you look like you need a blanket. Things are a bit strange here today. Or not strange, but unusual. They're always strange. I have two conversations for you. First, John Heyman of FanRag will be here to talk about his recent article naming 70 top trade possibilities for July. 70 is equal to almost one-tenth of all active major leaguers, so that was intriguing to me. And I also wanted to ask him about some of the method behind what he does, like the cultivation and maintenance of contacts, because, as we'll discuss in a moment, that's just something that's weird and mysterious and almost impossible to me, given my own inhibitions. Following that, we'll be joined, as usual, by one of our three rotating co-hosts, Jesse Spector, and he and I will discuss Mike Trout's really depressing injury, the Bryce Harper-Hunter Strickland brawl, although I don't know if Bryce Harper really deserves to have his name in the title, and I mean that in a positive way, and many other things, and it's a good conversation. I really think it is. But I've got to be honest with you, I'm not going to lie, I'm a little disappointed because we had some technical difficulties and some of the conversation just wasn't salvageable, and it was some of the parts I enjoyed the most, and we'll try to get back to those topics in the future, but right now it's a bit of a downer. That's the stressful thing about doing this podcast thing. You know, many years ago, and no one remembers this, but when I was doing the Pinstripe Bible, I jumped into the podcast thing, but there weren't apps to help you, and the general technology around it was kind of basic, and engineering and production was always really stressful and frightening, and I was never sure what I was going to come out with. And I had, about the fourth or fifth episode, I had a conversation with Rob Nyer, and it was some of the best baseball conversation I ever had. And I was so excited to post it, and when I got it all assembled, all of Rob's audio and most of mine sounded a bit like this. In other words, a bit like the subway announcements in New York used to sound. I was so demoralized that I stopped doing it right then and there. I just couldn't bring myself to deal with it anymore. And part of coming back years later and doing The Infinite Inning was getting over that experience. I'm easily traumatized, as you probably figured out by now. Anyway, I'm not going to let that happen with this podcast. We will be back next week. Everything here is really good. And if I hadn't mentioned it, you would have thought that Jesse's segment was a little shorter than it normally is. And it would have been balanced off by the John Heyman segment. And, you know, you would have been none the wiser, but I'm not going to lie to you. So there's your little peek behind the curtain. And on with the show. On with these generous guys. But before we get to John and Jesse, I was wondering, folks, do you ever feel like you're not wanted even when there's not a good reason for you to feel that way? I do all the time. I never feel lonelier than when I'm in a crowd, and if I'm at a party, it seems like even if I've known everyone for years and have great one-on-one relationships with everyone present or most people present, even if they're family, it seems as if they're all closer to each other than they are to me, and I start to detach. It's self-protective, the feeling of having your nose pressed against a window and seeing a warmth that you yourself can't experience is just too painful to endure. I've been this way as long as I can remember. When I was in first grade, I was convinced I was not popular with my classmates. I was invited to a birthday party, and I was dreading it, begged my mother not to make me go because I thought, why was I invited? None of these people like me. When it came to the actual event, a trip to the movie theater to see Star Wars in its first run, and I'd seen it a bunch of times by then, parenthetically. Movies stayed in theaters longer then, and retrospectively, it feels like I probably saw Star Wars at 35 birthday parties. We got to a theater with a balcony, an old-style one that regretfully no longer exists, and there was a scrum among the kids to sit next to me. I want to sit next to Steve. No, I want to sit next to Steve. I want to sit next to Steve. I was amazed. I had been so wrong. I'd like to report that my life changed as a result of that moment, and that I went on to a happy, well-adjusted adulthood marked by an excess of ego and confidence. But it wasn't true. The lesson didn't stick. Unfortunately, those feelings are just hardwired into my personality. Right or wrong, I'm going to feel like they don't want me around, whoever they is. But I do know of one baseball player for whom those feelings were actually true. The Dodgers spent most of the first third of the 20th century looking for a quality second baseman they could hold on to for a number of years. They'd have a good one for moments at a time, but somehow no one ever lasted. Things hit a real low point in the mid-1920s. In 1924, they got a huge season out of a guy named Andy High, but he broke his ankle the next year, and when he didn't hit immediately upon returning, they just waived him. It was premature, they had overreacted. He wound up with the Cardinals and was good enough to play on three pennant winners, so that was a mistake. But as a result, they went into 1926 with no second baseman whatsoever, and their manager, Uncle Robbie, Wilbert Robinson, decided to take a flyer on an International League player, Raymond Snooks Dowd, and arranged for him to come to camp from the Jersey City Skeeters on a try-and-buy scheme. And at first, it seemed like it was working out. Snooks had some things going for him. He was a career 307 hitter in a long International League career, and he had no power to speak of, but then not many middle infielders back then did, so that was no big deal. And he was terrifically fast, probably one of the fastest players in organized baseball at that time. We know that for a few reasons. First of all, he led the International League in stolen bases a couple of times. If you figure his International League stolen bases on a 162-game basis, he was averaging about 44 a year. Second of all, if you read descriptions of his play from his first tryout in the majors, which came in 1919, that year keeps coming up on this podcast and I need to figure out a way to stop it. You come across reports like, he was gifted with the winged feet of Mercury, or he hopped over the turf like the hound in pursuit of the elusive rabbit. That's pretty fast. I've seen a lot of Billy Hamilton, and I've yet to feel moved to comment that he hopped across the turf like a hound in pursuit of an elusive rabbit. You know, they used to do things before games like have faster players like George Case race a horse. Maybe we could arrange for Billy Hamilton to race a rabbit, but only if it's humane. To the rabbit. And to Billy Hamilton, too. Finally, we know that Snooks was fast because his major legacy in sports, if you could call it a legacy, comes not in baseball but in college football, where he played for Lehigh University. He's credited with one of the longest touchdowns in collegiate history, which, depending on what account you come across, is listed at 150 or 200 yards. How did he do that, given that a football field is only 100 yards long? Well, it seems that he recovered a fumble near his opponent's end zone, somehow got turned around in the scrum, and made a beeline for his own end zone, not realizing that the tackles he was breaking to his left and tackles he was breaking to his right were his own teammates trying to stop him from doing the unthinkable. He got down there, figured it out, somehow hooked a U-turn, and, I assume because everyone was just stunned into a total stillness, he made it all the way back up the field to score in the proper end zone. Snooks was given the starting second base and leadoff job for the Dodgers as of the third game of the 1926 season. He played two games, went 0 for 8, and was promptly returned to Jersey City. It wasn't the hitting that was at issue. Although I can't find evidence of this in the game stories from the day, what has come down to us is that Robbie found that Snooks didn't have the arm to make the throw from second to first base. It seems to me that this must have been a momentary injury that Snooks was trying to conceal. It seems unlikely that he played for as long as he did in the minors, and even under the eyes of Uncle Robbie during spring training, without anyone noticing that he was incapable of making the shortest throw in baseball. Nonetheless, he was gone back to the minors, and that's where things got kind of weird. Jersey City decided they didn't want him back, and they sold him to the Newark Bears. Dowd took his time reporting to the Bears, they were on a road trip, and by the time he showed up, they had their noses so out of joint, they didn't want him either. So he went back to Jersey City. And they said, "We don't own you anymore." And he went back to the Bears. They said, "We don't want you." So he went to both for a long period of time, just showing up so that no one could say that he had jumped the club and suspend him without pay. Every day, he'd shuttle back and forth between Jersey City and Newark. "Are you here again, Snooks? Get out of here, Snooks. Who asked you here, Snooks? Aren't we rid of you yet, Snooks?" Finally, he appealed to the president of the International League, who, after due deliberation, awarded him to the Newark Bears. And the Newark Bears were pissed. They said that the president of the International League had always had it in for the Newark Bears, and he was showing it by sticking them with Snooks Dowd. There have been many disputes in baseball history in which two clubs claimed the same player and engaged in a kind of legalistic tug of war to have that player's services. Think of the American and National League wars of the beginning of the 20th century, when a player like Nap Lajoie jumped from the Phillies to the Philadelphia A's and ended up under a Pennsylvania Supreme Court injunction which prevented him from playing anywhere in the state of Pennsylvania except with the Phillies, a complication which later required his trade to Cleveland, which is where we primarily remember him as playing today. In the 1980s, there was the strange case of Tim Belcher, who had been selected in the first round of the now-defunct January phase of the amateur draft by the New York Yankees, and 5 days later, baseball declared that he was eligible to be selected in the free agent compensation draft and headed off to the Oakland A's. That just makes no sense. You can't lose a player 5 days after he was drafted, but that's what baseball ruled, and Belcher went on to have a 14-year career as a starting pitcher, none of it with the Yankees. Cases like that come readily enough to mind, but examples like Snooks Dowd's, where two teams fought not to have a player assigned to their team, are much harder to recall. Snooks never got another chance at the major leagues. In fact, he never really got another chance at the International League. Once Newark and Jersey City passed, he went down to the Springfield Ponies of the Eastern League and barely hung on into the 1927 season, bouncing from Bridgeport to Hartford to Providence. And I would like to assert here that Franklin Pierce Adams was wrong, and that the saddest possible words in baseball are not Tinker to Evers to Chance, but Bridgeport to Hartford to Providence. His career ended that year. His speed would never be utilized in the major leagues, and his throwing arm would never be proven. He was 29 years old, and indisputably, he wasn't wanted. You know the old joke line, "It's not that I'm paranoid, it's just that everybody is out to get me"? It seems to me that those two are not mutually exclusive propositions. You can be paranoid, and they can be out to get you. That's a very dangerous situation when everything you know is right. Similarly, they might call you oversensitive, they might call you needy, they might say that you're insecure, and all those things might be true, and you also might have good reason to feel that way. And those sidelong glances that you see, those private conversations of which you're aware but are not quite privy to, you are not misinterpreting. Their eyeing you is an act of appraisal. You have been found wanting. They're planning to let you go. Your arm's just not good enough. They're waiting for the right time to let you know. I'll be back with John Heyman in just a moment. John, thank you for taking time to join me today.
No problem, anytime.
I'm curious about a couple of things before we talk about this massive list of trade possibilities that you posted at FanRag this week. 70 guys, which must be an enormous number of potential storylines to keep track of. I'm very curious about the kind of specialized field that you're in that you are in competition, maybe you don't see it this way, but and you can tell me if you don't, with guys like Ken Rosenthal to break stories in terms of trade rumors and firings and that kind of thing. And there's this almost elaborate ritual that's evolved on social media where you might tweet, there's an imminent trade between the Giants and the Rockies coming down or something, and then there'll be a confirmation from somebody else and then a final trade announcement. But it seems to me that with Twitter, a lot of it comes pre-digested. It happens very, very fast. There isn't necessarily a click to, through to a story that you might develop in a broader way because it's happening also fast on Twitter. And I wonder how that's changed the way you approach your job and maybe the way you perceive your role in the industry.
Well, probably it's just that you try to be sure to get something a little quicker. In the old days, you had until the deadline, which is usually around 11 p.m. or 12 midnight, to confirm stories and gather the info. So you'd have plenty of time. Now there is more competition to try to come up with the stories. And someone may think that it's negligible who's first, especially as many of the stories are first by seconds or possibly minutes. But I think the more stories that you come up with that are good, the more attention it'll bring to your site, and that's probably a positive in terms of gaining readership for all your stories.
Do you think that, well, let me put it this way, do you miss the old days when, you know, I can remember when it was all newspaper broadsheet that Peter Gammon, say, would, on a winter's Sunday, would write an entire broadsheet full of rumors, and I assume he had a week to develop things like that and to piece it all together. And like you said, now it's about speed and you're on to the next thing. Do you find one way or the other being more satisfying?
Well, I like to do the weekly notes, and I still do them for Thursdays that are long, and I have to give Peter Gammons a big hat tip because he was the originator of the notes. If something huge comes along that I think is competitive, I'll obviously write it or tweet it first before waiting for a week. Sometimes I'll wait for the week with something, and then I'll get scooped. But you know, those are the dangers that you take. If there's something that's very, very newsworthy and very timely, you try to get it out there. But, you know, I still hold a lot of things for the end of the week, which for me is Wednesday when I hand in the notes.
Given the nature of that a lot of this is happening on Twitter and the number of people who actually click through on Twitter is very limited compared to a platform like Facebook. I mean, something like a long notes column, you hope to get direct viewership for your website. But do you feel like because it just stays on Twitter that is almost a mission accomplished in and of itself?
I think that it seems like a lot of my readers are on Twitter. I have a much greater following on Twitter than I do on Facebook, but we do tweet the information onto Facebook as well. Maybe people don't know that I'm on Facebook or that we post the stories on Facebook as well, and you know that may be something I need to work on, but I think in the news gathering arena, Twitter is still a big deal, seems like to me anyway.
Let me ask you one other thing about your method, and it's something that somebody like me, who is more of a shy, reclusive kind of person, doesn't, in spite of the fact that we're having this conversation, doesn't always love picking up the phone. You've been doing this a long time, obviously, but if this isn't giving away any trade secrets, what is your method for cultivating sources, not only putting them on your side, but keeping them on your side and receptive to telling you things that there's not necessarily an upside in having in the public, but benefits your readership at least as much as it does them.
Well, if you do this for a long time, you certainly meet people, and you sometimes gain trust. Sometimes you do it through them following you on Twitter or Facebook, or it could be through phone calls or seeing them at the ballpark. So there are a lot of ways to meet people, and I think probably some of it is beneficial to the party who might be telling me something, and maybe some of it is just helping me out if they consider me trustworthy. I mean, there's a lot of ways to cultivate sources, but most of them take some time. I don't think there's any question about that.
So what's in it for them? Like, I mean, one of the things that's kind of in the media today or in the public discussion overall is, say, when we have these stories about what the Trump administration has done or not done, people talk about the motives of the people who are leaking the stories, whether it's the deep state or people who have some kind of axe to grind in another way. And without getting into that, which is not really the subject of this podcast, I wonder, when somebody will tell you, hey, the Yankees are working on a trade or the Dodgers are working on a trade, shopping this guy or that guy, what is the advantage, other than just kind of cultivating your friendship? And I'm sure that at this stage, with your reputation, your name opens certain doors in that way by itself. But what is their motivation usually in telling you that kind of thing?
Well, most of the stories are deals that are about to be signed or signed. In that case, it's just that it's coming out anyway. It's nothing negative. It's positive. It's a little bit different than political coverage, where they're is more often something negative about what's reported. Usually there isn't really anything negative. And if it's something like someone's working on a trade, which is possible, oftentimes the signings will just come, and there isn't really a major lead up to them or the trades as well. So they're just about to be announced anyway, so I don't think there's much downside to somebody telling you something is close to happening or something is happening. The political arena is probably a little bit more interesting, and it takes a little more courage on the political reporter's part. There's a lot more negativity to it, it seems, especially lately.
Is that different in the sense that, say, back in the 70s, when you had ownership that was more willing to criticize players in the media, and you might have stories like Charlie Finley was, you know, incredibly unhappy with this player or that player, the Yankees were down on this guy and were shopping him, you would have almost ownership, for whatever motivation, looking to use the reporters as a vehicle to show up or embarrass the players or make some kind of statement, whereas now the information is, as you say, almost more transactional.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are certain personalities that were willing to do that. I wasn't around for the Charlie Finley years, but I was around for George Steinbrenner, and I can remember times where he would be upset at a player and would go public with it. The motivation might be to get the player going, or he may just be mad at the player not doing well. But in any case, it is news if the owner says something negative about the player. It could end up leading to a transaction or a diminished playing time or something like that. Back in those days, fantasy wasn't as popular, but nowadays, I guess diminished playing time is a bigger story. But it still was interesting if the owner got down on a player to the point of willingness to go public with it. Obviously, Steinbrenner was willing to do that. We don't have that many owners that are that colorful, shall we say, now.
Which is probably better all around, just for the peace of the game.
Well,
no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, maybe not for me, but yeah, but for mostly everybody else.
One of the things I find most interesting about these kinds of stories, like you said, that not the negative ones, but the ones about trades that might or might not happen, is that how many of them, and you can tell me if maybe this is less true today, but as a historian, when I go back and I might look at newspapers from even the 20s or 30s or 40s, and they will propose that a certain team is about to acquire a certain player, and even in the Gammons notes that we talked about, and this is no knock on Peter, he was doing an incredible job, but you know, maybe 80% of that stuff turns out not to be true, and maybe it falls apart in the negotiation stage, or it just never happened. But it's interesting almost how the degree to which we end up teasing things that never happened, and yet people still really love to hear about it.
Right. Well, I would say it's still interesting if there was a discussion. So, I would say some of it may not be true, but more often it's a matter of something that fell apart but was discussed. I guess there are times where people are used or people hear wrong, or you might misunderstand a cryptic text or something, where something could turn out not to be true at all. Anything is possible. Nobody bets a thousand, but I think it's still interesting if something had been discussed, even if it doesn't come to fruition.
Oh, no, absolutely. It's just one of those rare instances where you get the coming attractions for a movie, and the coming attractions looks great, but the movie might not actually come out. Turning to what you've been writing about the trade market, and the trade market specifically this year, we saw, going back to last season, some trades that, be it Aroldis Chapman or Andrew Miller, or then in the offseason Adam Eaton and so on, that the price right now to get a really quality veteran sent your way is not just a prospect or two or a few random arms from your organization, but a really tip-top prospect, whether that's Gleyber Torres or Lucas Giolito. And I'm curious to what extent you see that high price level inhibiting players moving as we move towards the deadline this year.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the price is up for guys. You know, I do think that the team still covet prospects quite a bit. I think in the case of Chris Sale, we're talking about one of the best five pitchers in baseball, and that starting pitching is a rare commodity. And beyond that, he had a contract where he was paid probably closer to less than half of what he's worth per year basis. So there's a major value to that, as there is to the prospects. So I don't think there's been a devaluation of the prospects. As you could see, I think the price of everything has gone up, stars and prospects. Somebody paid $31 million for Makata and then paid $31 million in tax, and then he was traded. Luis Robert, $26 million, and that was hefty taxed as well. So the value of these prospects are high. It's up, but the value of the stars is up too. And I wouldn't say that people are just giving away top prospects now. You have to get a really good player back. I think in the case of Eaton, we thought that was an overpay at the time. Eaton had played very well now for Washington. I think the issue there was probably it might have been an overpay, and also the fact that he had 4 years to go and was paid probably one-third of what he's worth, maybe a little bit more than that, but certainly a fraction of what he's worth. That increased his value quite a bit, and they just happened to need that one piece, and that's why they were willing to maybe overpay a little bit, but they didn't get the types. We love Lucas Giolito. We've heard about him. He was a high draft choice, but he's not Moncada or Kopech, at least as far as I've heard. So, we'll see. Prospects don't always turn out. I mean, how many 5-tool players have we heard about that really never became more than marginal major leaguers? And I can think of probably four Mets outfielders who fit that bill. So it happens a lot. We just don't know. It's hard to know who's going to become a superstar and who's going to be just an average player.
Going back to Shane Mack and Sean Abner, probably that's the how many Mets
Shane
outfielders.
Shane Mack, yeah, I don't. I was going to say it was a guy named Escobar. It was a guy named Ochoa who
sure.
played for a long time, but never became a star player. There was a guy named, I believe, it was Fernando Martinez. I think something like that. I can't even remember. I might have his name wrong. Basically, just got a cup of coffee, and I think he might have played a little bit with Houston or some other team. Briefly, but there were several that were considered 5-tool players that really turned out to have one tool or not even that one tool.
Do you get the sense, though, given the expectation of the kind of high prices that Rick Hahn set and that Brian Cashman set in dealing his relievers, that it might have led a team like the Pirates to maybe too high a bar for somebody like Andrew McCutchen? And obviously they couldn't predict that he would fall off the table the way that he has so far this year, but that maybe they negotiated themselves into a corner and not moving the player before it was too late?
Well, sometimes you make that mistake and you hold on to somebody too long. They set what they felt was a fair price. They didn't know what the Eaton price was at that time. That they were in competition with Chicago, trading their guy as Chicago was trading Eaton. And I do think that the White Sox got quite a bit. The Nats decided they much would prefer to have Eaton. They, looking back on it, they thought the price tag on McCutchen was way too high. We don't know the exact price tag, but I think the fact that one guy, Eaton, had 4 years to go and one guy, McCutchen, had 2 years to go for, I think his salary was at least double of what Eaton's salary was, too. I think those were prime factors. And I think the fact that McCutchen really was only an average player last year, and less so this year, I think that was another factor. And I think the Nats look pretty smart at this moment. We were all a little surprised that you would pay a lot for Eaton and not for McCutchen at the time, but they may have known more than we did, which is quite possible.
I do think that maybe Eaton was a little underrated going into that deal, especially, as you said, when you throw in the contractual status. But, I mean, McCutchen was obviously a guy who was playing it at an annual MVP level for a while, and the question was whether that was a one-off off year or something had dramatically changed in his level of ability. And it seems almost inexplicably, given his age, that he has hit a wall younger than a lot of players would.
Yeah, it's a surprise. He's quite young. He's only around 30 or 31, I think, at this point. You wouldn't think that somebody would go from a superstar for several years to average to below average that quickly. I wouldn't quite give up on him yet, but the trend is obviously startlingly terrible at this moment. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to think of somebody else who was a superstar for several years and then what in a seeming prime went to average, then below average. I really, at this, off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody. I'm sure there probably are a few others, but it's certainly rare.
This is one of the names that comes to my mind, and it's almost before my time, but Cesar Cedeño had that kind of career arc, also a center fielder with speed and power. He killed a guy. That didn't help, probably, but he fell off. And I do wonder if this is before birth certificates were as regulated as they are now, if maybe he was playing a little younger than he actually was. But you're right. It's you have to look far afield, decades in the past, to find somebody like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad example. Yeah, he was awfully good for 4 or 5 years. I don't think it was close to MVP like McCutchen, but I have to go back and look at it. He was certainly speed and some power combo, was really good, and then became an average player for a long time at a younger age. I mean, there are guys who, if you look at Tim Raines, and I did vote for him for the Hall of Fame. He was one of the best players in the game for 7 years and then became slightly above average player for the last two-thirds of his career. He was certainly productive for a while afterward, too. McCutchen's is much more alarming in that he went to average, now well below average, at least through 2 months of the season. As I said, I'm not giving up on him. May come back a bit. May end up like Raines, which isn't bad, which put him in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
We will see, but the trend line is worse than Raines at this point.
I think I'm too smart to relitigate Tim Raines at this time on this. He just got.
No, there's no need to. Yeah, I voted for him.
I would have to.
I think he was worthy of the Hall of Fame, but he wasn't. I didn't think he was the slam dunk that some people thought, but I think generally we've been too tough anyway, so. Keeping that in mind, he should have been easily over the bar because I think there are other guys that we give 10 and 20% to that should have gotten more support, and some of them even should have gotten in. I think he got a just result getting in eventually. He wasn't an obvious first ballot Hall of Famer. He's not Ricky Henderson. He's not Ken Griffey. But he had a terrific, terrific and Hall of Fame-worthy career. So some people liked him even better than that, and that's fine. That's what makes a horse race. He had, like I said, he was one of the best players in the game for 7 years. But then he had two-thirds of his career where he was mostly a slightly above average yet productive player, not a star the last, at least I would say, 12 to 15 years. It's not like Ricky Henderson, who was a superstar for 15 to 20 years. Really good player, even a great player, but not to Ricky Henderson, not Ken Griffey. Not that that's a crime or anything like that.
You have to be careful.
Clearly
what
short
say.
Of those players, you know.
Yeah, well, without turning the conversation to the Hall of Fame topic, which is one that has become so much of a muchness. With players like Reigns, and there's an interesting issue of timing in that the 70s and the 80s were a little bit offense-suppressed, pitching heavy, and yet guys didn't necessarily pile up the obvious numbers that would make them easy to get in the Hall of Fame. And now we're since 96, say, we're in kind of an offense-heavy period, so we've kind of undervalued the numbers from three decades ago and maybe might overvalue the numbers now. And there are some adjustments that are still shaking out in people's thinking. But as I said, that's a conversation for another time. I was curious if, given the people that you're talking to, two of the big pitching names that we hear on the market and have been hearing in one case for months, Jose Quintana and Gerrit Cole, neither of them is pitching up to quite the level that they did last year. And I'm assuming that that is not going to put any dent in their market at all or what they might return in trade. You're not hearing that anybody's a little more gun-shy or is going to hold back a little bit on those two players should they be available?
Well, you know, I think it's all taken into account. And Quintana has not had a great year to this point. Cole, I thought was pretty good up until the last couple of starts. I do think that the Pirates probably won't trade Cole. They've got a few years to go for a free agency. They aren't the clear rebuild mode that the White Sox are in. There's about a half dozen teams that are in a clear rebuild mode. Pirates don't really do that. They kind of straddle the line a little bit. And I don't think now with more than 2 years to go for free agency that they're going to be anxious to trade Cole. But I think everything counts. If a guy's not doing well, his value is going to go down a little bit, but I still think both those guys will have big, big values. Quintana, because he's got 4 years, just like Eaton, at a very, very reasonable rate for overall performance, even if he has not been great this year. I do think the possibility of several starters being out on the market could affect things as well. I think Irvin Santana will at least be out there. I think Alex Cobb will likely be out there. Right now, the Rays say they don't have anybody really out there, but I think ultimately they're probably not a contender, so they'll consider Archer and Odorizzi as well. And there are just a lot of potential starting pitchers. We'll see about Zach Greinke. Right now, the D-backs are clearly in it, but if they fall out, you know, they have a new regime that didn't sign him, and he makes a lot of money for Arizona. So it'll be interesting to see whether he could hit the market as well. There's a lot of starting pitchers out there. I think that's the biggest factor in terms of the value of these guys rather than a slight underperformance.
Two of the big contenders that are in position to add pitching in particular are the Red Sox and Cubs. But they're in an interesting position in that one of the reasons that they are so successful is that they already have a lot of their best prospects established in the majors, and they're no longer prospects. So the kind of guys that another team might ask for in trade would be, in the Red Sox case, Rafael Devers, who's obviously one of the top prospects in the game and somebody they might need and have ready sooner than later. The Cubs, with Eloy Jimenez, is really the big piece that they have left on the farm. And obviously that would be a huge cost to them and damage their ability to maintain this level in the future. Do you see them being willing, in pursuit of a division title this year, being willing to move pieces like that?
Well, obviously they'd prefer not to move them, but I would think they would consider moving their big pieces. Look at last year, the Cubs traded Gleyber Torres. They might have been slightly more motivated because they hadn't won that title in 108 years, but they're a team that's motivated to win. They're a big market team. They're willing to take a bit of a gamble to win now, so I wouldn't rule anything out with the Cubs. Their MO seems to be on the pitching front to grab a hot pitcher when possible, rather than, I know they signed Lester to a long deal, but I think generally they'd like to keep very good position players around for a long time and have that core and try to grab hot pitchers when they can to grab titles that way. And not a bad strategy. They're pretty smart guys.
In Tom Verducci's book, they quote Theo Epstein as saying, "We can get anybody to pitch." And last year, to a certain extent, he was able to make good on that kind of statement. And this year, it's been a little harder. So I think it's a really fascinating aspect of their season, especially with them having a hard time pulling away from 500, as to whether he'll renege on that philosophy.
No, I think that's their philosophy. I don't know about anybody, but they'll look to upgrade that rotation probably. I think that they had a long season last year. They've eased the guys in a bit. We might see a little better performance than we have started to see one out of Hendricks and a couple of the other guys. But they still have a great core positionally, and they have very talented pitchers. So even as is, they're a threat to win it all. I'm not going to judge them harshly based on basically a quarter of the season.
Of the surprise contenders, I'm talking about the Twins, the Brewers, the Rockies, the Diamondbacks, which do you see being most aggressive and shifting from being a team that might collect prospects ordinarily to dealing for pitching upgrades or any upgrades?
Yeah, the Rockies are in it to win it. I think that became clear when they signed those big free agents, Ian Desmond and the relievers, Holland and Dunn. They spent a lot of money for them in the off season, and they are trying to win this year. They are doing a great job. They had a rough spring training. They bounced back from that, and I think they may feel that this could be their year. I think it's a harder case to make for those other organizations. I give Milwaukee credit. I like the way they're going. Same with Minnesota, although I think they're a little behind Milwaukee. Arizona, I think, was very unlucky last year. They were better than they showed, or just didn't play up to the level they should have played. So they're not a bad team, but they've got a new regime. I'm not sure they have enough depth to really be a title contender, and I could see them as a seller more than I could as a buyer, but they have been very good, so I wouldn't rule it out. I don't think Milwaukee is likely to be a buyer, nor do I think Minnesota is likely to be a buyer.
Last question, John. The Marlins are for sale, and whether that's to the Derek Jeter, Jeb Bush group or not, we don't know. You've written about it. A lot of people have written about it. One of the things that seems to traditionally happen when a club is for sale is they start dealing away players who are going to serve as long-term debt because that can affect the purchase price of the club. And whereas I don't think somebody like Derek Jeter wants to buy just the shell of a baseball team, I wonder if you're hearing anything, and there really has been very little written about this so far, but in terms of the Marlins possibly dealing off or trying to deal off some of their long-term commitments, particularly Giancarlo Stanton or either of the other two great outfielders that they have, in order to get the payroll down and maybe smooth the skis for a possible sale?
Yeah, I think they will be sellers, and I think it'll probably happen after the All-Star game. As you know, the All-Star game is in Miami, so there are a lot of factors here at play for the Marlins. I do think they're likely to be sellers. Does that mean they can trade Giancarlo Stanton? I don't think that's likely from what I hear. It does seem like he signed a very good deal, more power to him. I don't think they're going to be teams clamoring to take on that contract, which escalates in a hurry very, very soon. So I just don't see that happening. Wayne Chen, I think, is not really tradable. Prado, I think, is a tough trade at this point. D. Gordon, not tradable from what I heard, although these guys are on the, not Stanton. I didn't put Stanton on my list of 70, but and Chen is not really tradable at all. I did put D. Gordon because he's probably not tradable, but I guess it's a lot less money, so you never know if they pay some of it down. I think it's just going to hurt the sale price of the team. It's not like some of these guys are close to tradable. They just made a mistake paying this much money in some of these cases, and it's going to come off the price of the team, I think.
John, I really appreciate your taking the time and dropping by the podcast, and pleased to be colleagues with you at FanRec.
Same here. Nice talking to you, Steve.
Thank you.
Town crier, and everybody knows I'm a little down.
Now it's time. I feel like Jimmy Dodd on the old Mickey Mouse Club program. Now it's time. Now is the time when we welcome Jesse Spector back to the program. How are you, Jesse?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm functional. And before we went on the air, we were in touch a couple of hours ago, or more than a couple of hours ago. It was like, you know, what are we going to talk about? There's not that much happening in baseball this weekend, just a run-of-the-mill jejun kind of May. And then it seems like all the stuff in the world happened in the last few hours.
Yeah, I would say that for sure. It's hard to pick what the top thing even is, so I'll let you do that.
Well, I think for me, because it's a loss for all of us, whether you're an Angels fan or not, if you're just a baseball fan. And gosh knows, for fantasy fans who probably picked him first overall in every single draft in the nation this year, it's hard to think of who else would go first. But Mike Trout tears his ulnar collateral ligament in the thumb, and who knew you had a UCL in your thumb? And he's on the DL, and it sounds like it could be surgery and a long-term thing. So I guess the question I want to ask you, Jesse, is why can't we have nice things?
Well, I think you can look back to November, and there's a good explanation of why we can't have nice things. That question sort of answers itself here in 2017. Yeah, maybe a little bit of chicken egg before that, because there was a inability to have nice things even leading up to that, so I'm not really sure. But yeah, there's your answer. And I think we did know that you had an ulnar collateral ligament in your thumb because of Andrelton Simmons a couple of years ago.
Oh, true.
Doing the same thing. So the question now that I think has to be asked is, why are the Angels so bad at protecting ulnar collateral ligaments in the thumb? Questions need to be asked, and really, it's about time that somebody put the Mets training staff off the hook here, because you know, they've been taking it on the chin for around about 10 years now.
And with the Mets, again, to pick up your theme here about how this is we're sinners in the hands of an angry God, going back to November, with the Mets, the issue is not so much the crime, but the cover-up.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it's just this idea that they have no idea what they're doing. And Jerry Krasnick wrote a whole thing about it for ESPN, about how they handle things and Jeff Wilpon's involvement. And what other owner in baseball, not that Jeff Wilpon is the owner, Fred is, but you know, whatever, it's the family business. What other ownership group meddles in injuries like that? It's bizarre and confusing, and you know there are those people who will point you to the fact that the Mets have not won the World Series since the Wilpons took over, and particularly since Nelson Doubleday was kicked to the curb. So there's that. And if we're talking about, like you said, sinners in the hands of an angry God, yeah. I mean, just to get back to Trout though, that's rough to see. And he does it stealing a base, head first slide, innocuous play, wasn't contacted by anybody, jammed his thumb on second base, which happens. And now you get the whole hue and cry of, oh, nobody should ever be sliding head first, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, I guess, but it's not like guys don't also hurt themselves sliding feet first. It's not like that's been a 100% injury-free enterprise over the course of baseball history. Guys get hurt. It happens. It stinks. I'm glad that it's only going to be a couple of months for Trout, probably, and just hope that when he comes back that he's the same Mike Trout that he's always been, and he doesn't rush himself to get back to a team that is milquetoast with him and probably rotting stale toast without him.
One of the mysteries of the season, or it's not a mystery, it will be now if it continues, is that the Angels were kicking around 500 with Trout. There's not a whole lot else there without him. It feels like it should be a question now, like if they ever win another game. And we know no team is that bad or not that sustained bad over the course of a whole season, no matter who they lose. But the Angels are the kind of team that it feels like they could challenge that.
It does. At the same time, they play in the American League West, and that's a real rough group right now, and especially the injury problems that the Mariners have had all year. We know that the A's are what the A's are, and we know that the Rangers are just sort of treading water. And yeah, they had that big winning streak, but then they immediately fell right backwards, and they can't seem to get their act together. So the Angels, they stink. But they're in a division full of stink, and there's a reason that the Astros are already up double digits, because they're a legitimately good team, you know, much like the Nationals, who we will get to momentarily. Much like the Nationals, you know, playing in a division where there's like one other kind of decent team, in this case the Rangers, and the Nats case the Mets, and that team has had its issues and struggles, and you know, the rest of the division is sort of a hot plate of garbage. So, you know, that's what you get. And you can get a team like last year's Marlins that kicked around 500 and, you know, the fringes of the wild card race all year when they had guys healthy. And, you know, the Angels now could have been that team, but they don't have guys healthy. And it is also important to remember that we're still in May, at least as of the moment that we're talking, and the Twins are in first place. That's not going to last. I think it was the first year of the Nationals that they were like in first place around the All-Star break. And it's just like, yeah, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop on this. You can play good baseball or halfway decent baseball for a couple of months. It helps if you have Mike Trout having the season of his life. And that's what really stinks about this, is that he was on his way this year to just doing ridiculous things. Maybe this could have been the year that he went 40-40. Who knows? We'll never know. And that's the real shame of it, because that's what's robbed from us.
Right. I was going to say he was having a Joe DiMaggio year, and then I realized that was probably an insult to the year that he was having. Is so much better than a Joe DiMaggio year. And secondarily, that it made me feel a little down because Joe DiMaggio got hurt a lot too and had weird things happen to him, like somebody putting him in a diathermy machine, setting it to boil, and then walking away and turning him into a poached egg. He had bone spurs on his one of his heels. It kept him out for most of a season. But this is how good Trout was, and this is kind of an oblique way of coming at it, but I thought this was really incredible. If you look at the splits for the Angels, as left fielders, their OPS for the aggregate for everybody who's played left field for them ranks 18th in the majors. If you look at their right fielders, they've gotten so little from right field because Calhoun has been not at his best by far. They rank 29th in the majors. Obviously, in center field, that primarily being Trout until today, they rank first by far. By himself, again, first in center, 18th in left, 29th in right, their outfield combined ranks fifth overall. He himself lifts them all the way up.
And this becomes interesting. Let's say he misses basically June and July, but he plays 4 months. I don't know if he winds up with enough plate appearances to qualify in that case. You know, the All-Star break is in July. Maybe if it's a quick comeback, because they say, like, if it's surgery, 5 to 8 weeks. So maybe you're looking at the All-Star break. Can he still be in the MVP mix, even if, you know, he's missed a third of the season, basically? Especially if the Angels are like 10-40 without him. What do you do then? Is that more of a case for Mike Trout to be the MVP? That's the question that intrigues me off in the distance once we hope that, you know, there's a perfectly normal recovery with no setbacks of any kind and he comes back and he's Mike Trout and just picks up where he left off.
If you look at, and I don't want to say that WAR has to be a proxy for the MVP vote. Obviously, there's story. There are other things that go into it. So we shouldn't let the number do our thinking for us. I'm not saying that. Yeah. But just as a guideline to the question you just raised, right now the top five in the American League are Trout at 3.5 wins above replacement. I'm doing Baseball Reference version. Aaron Judge is second at 3. Corey Dickerson third at 2.6. Brett Gardner, believe it or not, 2.2, tied with Avisail Garcia at 4th and 5th. Jose Altuve at 6, 2.1. He's tied with Sano. Mookie Betts, Carlos Correa at 2. And the March King, Souza, at 1.8. That rounds out the top 10. So the question is, who is going to sail by Trout in the interim? I don't necessarily know that any of those guys are going to do it, because not all of them have the track record, of being up that far.
The other, I guess yesterday, there was a column in the New York Daily News about could Aaron Judge be in the MVP mix? And I said, today's May 28th. In other words, like, just cool off. Let's find out who the NBA MVP is before we really start talking about the baseball MVP. And obviously, I have already broken that rule, but that's within the context of talking about the guy who's won two and has been in the top two of the MVP every year that he's been in the league. So I feel like we're fair to be moving in that rather than speculating on a guy who's been in the major leagues for 3 months,
right,
two of which are this season. And while Aaron Judge has been phenomenal, Let's pump the brakes a little bit. If you're talking about who could pass Trout, though, and especially the season that they're having, we just talked about it, you know, in the American League West, they're already running away with that division in a way that the Cubs ran away with their division last year. So you can kind of just start thinking about that. I like Altuve. You know, that could be the one that goes on his plaque, 2017 American League MVP, when he's a Hall of Famer 20 years from now, which I think he's on that track. And am I off base on that to think that Jose Altuve is?
No, not at all. And I mean, he finished third last year. He won the batting title at 338 and spiked his numbers with 24 home runs. And he seems like the kind of guy to me who probably would have won a couple already, like 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when batting average had a little more cachet than it does now.
When is the last time a second baseman won the American League MVP? Or
well,
MVP?
Without looking, Pedroia did.
Yeah, Pedroia in 08.
Right. And so since
not
you,
often.
Yeah, it's not. And since you bring up Pedroia, he got hurt today too, and he's kind of been hurt on and off. And it's not that he was having a Trout-like year or a year that was going to earn him another MVP, but I think it's interesting because there's been a lot of controversy over how well or not well the Red Sox have done, and they're not hitting. They have about a league-average offense. They've gotten nothing from third base. I think the worst performance at third base in the majors, they're hitting .216 overall. Sandoval may be back sometime soon, but you don't know what you're going to get. They might be, because he sprained his wrist today, without Pedroia for a while. I wonder how long this club can hold on.
I don't know. I think that a lot of it also comes back to the pitching, which, aside from Chris Sale, has been eh.
Right.
It's like, I mean, obviously, Kimbrel's been great out of the bullpen, and Joe Kelly has finally put it together as a setup man. Is it? Can we say that after he's pitching, you know, 19, 20 games, whatever it is? Maybe.
Well, he always had the stuff. He just
seems like he's found his calling. Yeah.
He was always a guy as a starter. Everybody said, wow, he throws really hard. But he somehow never struck anybody out. He's not striking him out now.
But now he throws like 100 miles an hour. So he's not striking guys out. But when he throws, like, that's the thing. And this is something that I've talked to players about lately for something that I'm working on for way down the road. But about hitting a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, that, like, you have less margin for error to make good contact on it because it's moving so fast, even though 0.04 of a second is the difference between 90 and 100 as far as it getting to the plate. But 0.04 of a second, I guess, does make a lot of difference. And we see that it makes a lot of difference. And unless you square it up, the way that guys squared up Kyle Farnsworth, you know, time after time after time after time after time throughout his career. But if you have 100 with even the slightest bit of movement, which Joe Kelly does, then you know, you've got something that you can kind of hang your hat on. And at least you know, that's what he's got. And he hasn't given up a home run all year. So they're clearly not squaring it.
Possibly the best T-shirt that I've ever seen in my life. And I say this knowing that I'm currently wearing a Swamp Thing T-shirt drawn by the late Bernie Wrightson. And he just passed away. So blessed be his memory. He was a great artist. I was walking around outside Yankee Stadium one time and I passed a woman and her T-shirt said, "Anyone but Farnsworth."
Yeah, that was, I think hashtag ABF was one of the early baseball Twitter things that I, you know, kind of caught sight of. He was not well liked by Yankee fans, and kind of with good reason. He was dependable for coming in, throwing a straight fastball, and letting you down.
And yet that stuff was so seductive that they kept coming back to it. And maybe that's the Joe Kelly story to some extent also, except that it happens to be working, at least for the moment.
I think that the difference with Kelly is that like he was in that starter reliever limbo for such a long time. I mean, even last year, he still started 6 games.
Right.
So you know, this is the first time that he's been a full-time reliever, and you know, it's working. And the funny thing is he did strike out guys last year, because I'm looking at his page now, 10.8. you know, K9 last year, so he did have that going, and that's, I guess, why I thought it continued to this year when he's only got 15 strikeouts and 22 and a third innings, which is surprising when he's throwing as hard as he is, but the FIP is way lower, so he's got that going for him.
You know, I this is kind of circling back, but I keep thinking about the thing with the Mets and the injuries, and I wonder if they, almost like somebody has to check the insurance policy before they actually admit that a player is hurt. I don't, maybe they're just not keeping up the premiums. Maybe they've, rather than admit players with pre-existing conditions, they've decided to invest in a high-risk pool that is not sufficiently financed. I don't know the answer, but it's very weird.
And you can look at the entire David Wright saga and come up with more questions than answers, so I don't know, and I cannot imagine. It's just such a weird thing where they're like, this guy's obviously injured, and we have a 10-day disabled list now. So basically, if you think a guy is going to miss a week, put him on the DL. And what they do time and again is, oh, we're going to hold him out for a couple of days. And then inevitably, like, the guy gets in a pinch-hitting situation, or he pinch-runs or something, and then they're resetting the clock on the DL, and it becomes a nightmare. Like, oh, why don't you go for an MRI? I don't feel like it. Okay, well, you know, go ahead, you know, we'll see how it goes. And sure, I don't believe that Noah Syndergaard's injury was related to him not taking the MRI, but you have to say to the guy, look, you are very, very important to us. I know you don't like to get in the tube. It's uncomfortable. Nobody likes to get an MRI. But this is something that's important, and you are not taking another pitch on a major league mound until you get in that tube and we find out if there's anything wrong with you because you came out of a game because your arm hurt. The mismanagement of that is ludicrous.
You know, you already said the thing that I'm going to say, but I do think it's worth emphasizing because as a cancer guy, I have to go for regular MRIs, and it is among the most difficult things that I have to do, whatever it is, a few times a year, a couple of times a year. I never knew how claustrophobic I was. I never had a reason to until I had to get in those things, and you're put in this metallic coffin. It's loud. They put headphones on you and pump Muzak in your ears at high volume so you can't hear it, and you're just wedged in there. I have to take a lot of Valium, and even then it doesn't really work. So I do wonder, I don't know if this was hubris on Syndergaard's part, or maybe, like you said, he really is that phobic, and if that's the case...
Probably? I don't know. And this is my ignorance. I've never had an MRI. Can you close your eyes in there?
You can close your eyes, but the sense of claustrophobia, at least for me, is not relieved by that because depending on what body part they're looking at, your arms can be pinned. They might even put a rubber band around your ankles to keep you from moving them. And you're just totally constricted and just popped into this drawer. You're the filling in a sausage casing. And so it really is that uncomfortable. And I hope you never have to. You're very lucky, and I hope you never have to undergo one. Before we devote more time to the Mets than they probably deserve on a night like this, although they're kind of just an endlessly fascinating subject to talk about because dysfunction, folly, always is. The other thing I wanted to mention is that since you brought up David Wright was recently shut down again. He's still not anywhere near coming back. Adrian Beltre, who's been out all year, came back tonight, and it was such a good feeling. He's on the verge of 3,000 hits. He's a guy who's going to the Hall of Fame. David Wright is such a tragic figure in a way. I mean, he's wealthy. He's alive. It's not like Ross Young's where a player died mid-career. This is a guy who had probably 50 to 60% of a Hall of Fame career and then just nothing, full stop. The other big story from today, or there are a whole bunch of big stories from today, Giants-Nationals, there's bad blood between the two teams going back to a playoff meeting in 2014. In the eighth inning of the game, Hunter Strickland wings one at Bryce Harper's hip. Bryce Harper takes exception, goes running out to the mound, kind of faints with his helmet as if he's going to bounce the helmet off of Hunter Strickland. Instead, he tosses it away, throws a punch that misses. There's a huge brawl. Everybody comes running out onto the field. The part for me that I thought was interesting was George Contos, the Giants reliever, had to be dragged off by three of his own teammates. He just was in such a rage, apparently, that they just kept backing him off as he's going, let me at him. And he's still going, let me at him, all the way down the dugout stairs. And, the Nationals won at any rate. It's still a difficult season for the Giants. But I don't know. Is there any greater meaning to this other than the boys will be boys and so on and so forth?
You've got, like, the CJ Nitkowskis of the world telling you, oh, well, you know, if you've never played the game, you have no right to question the people who are playing the game and the way they do things. That's baloney. You absolutely do have that right, and it's people who have had that right and have exercised it who have forced Major League Baseball over the years to change on any number of issues. And you can't tell me that this is an issue that doesn't need to be resolved, because people get hurt. People get hurt constantly by balls being thrown at them, and it's just a matter of time before something really, really serious happens. It happened really, really seriously in 1920, and that prompted a full measure of changes that you can certainly go into. But everybody knows that Hunter Strickland was throwing at Bryce Harper intentionally. If he misses badly, well, then it's potential catastrophe for Bryce Harper. And you cannot have that. And there's no reason to have that. And the way to prevent that from happening is to have in these situations, when a guy is obviously throwing at somebody and there's enough people who have played the game of baseball in the front office of Major League Baseball on Park Avenue, Joe Torre can watch a game and know, yeah, that guy was throwing at him on purpose. I'm going to suspend him for 30 games because that's what has to happen. If that's the penalty, if it's like, all right, you did that, you're missing a month. See ya. This would not be a problem anymore. And we don't need to have, like, how long did Zach Greinke miss a couple of years ago because he got hurt, not in a, in, you know, not from having the ball thrown at, but from the fight. From the fight that happened afterwards. Like, it's just stupid to allow this to continue, and yet they do, because this is the way that it's been handled for years. The players take care of themselves. Get out of here with that nonsense. This is not 1920. This is not 1946. This is not 1972. It's 2017. These guys are making millions of dollars a year. You have millions of dollars invested in them. You have millions of dollars coming in from people who want to see the best possible product on the field. It's bad enough when you lose Mike Trout because of an innocuous slide at second base. Do you want to lose Bryce Harper because he got hit in the head? Do you want to lose Bryce Harper because he got hurt in a fight? Do you want to lose Bryce Harper because, you know, any number of things that could have happened in that situation? Absolutely not. And that's, Mike Trout's not preventable. What happened with Bryce Harper is preventable. And thank goodness nobody was really seriously hurt coming out of that. People are there saying, oh, look at Buster Posey. He's not stepping in for his pitcher. He's, that shows you what he really thinks of Hunter Strickland. Maybe. At the same time, Buster Posey was on the concussion disabled list in April. Is he really a guy who should be rushing into a place where fists are flying? And Posey said that for me. Like, Mike Morse is a huge dude and he's getting bounced around out there. You want me to go out there? No! That's stupid. Why should Buster Posey get himself hurt on account of Hunter Strickland's dumbass?
Listening to your list of do you want to lose Bryce Harper because, I was thinking that that same year that Joe DiMaggio had the bone spurs that I mentioned earlier, the only healthy Yankee was Tommy Henrich, and Casey Stengel told him, don't eat fish. So I'd like to add to that, do you want to lose Bryce Harper because he choked on a fishbone?
No.
You don't want to lose him at all.
No, you don't.
The thing that I don't understand about what Hunter Strickland did is Bryce Harper hits home runs off of everybody. He hit them then, he hits them now. And it was Hunter Strickland who had a historic postseason that year. He gave up, I think, 6 home runs in 6 innings.
Yeah, it's not just Bryce Harper hits home runs off everybody. It's that in 2014, Hunter Strickland gave up home runs to everybody.
Right.
Like, is he going to go, is he now, like, is this his revenge tour?
Liam Neeson is Hunter Strickland in
I Will Find You, and I Will Hit You in the Ass with a Fastball. Come on.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, and I don't know why you would want to dredge up memories of that if you were Hunter Strickland. And I do think you're right in that they're saying it's not a contact sport, so you can't slide into second base and take out the second baseman. You can't kill the catcher on a play at home plate. So why should you be able to throw a projectile at somebody at 100 miles an hour? It's not consistent with everything else that they're doing.
That's the other part of it, is these guys throw harder and harder and harder. And yeah, there's helmets, but you really want to take that chance?
It works so well in the NFL.
Yeah, Joe Mauer's never been the same since everything that went down with his concussions. So, like, you don't have to kill somebody. You can just end a guy's career. Oh, wonderful. Keep doing that in Major League Baseball.
Right. There's no place for it, and I do think to, I'm not going to embark on that romantic word again, but I do, there's a certain, we'll watch a Western movie. John Wayne is facing off at high noon against the bad guy, and they both shoot each other to death in the street and we'll eat popcorn and think that that's a great thing that happened. High adventure, the old Wild West and all that. But when you have the reality of it, there, if it wasn't just a story, there, even if it's a real thing, like the gunfight at the OK Corral, there are dead people at the end of that. And you can have some of that with the beanball wars in baseball in the 30s or 40s. Even with the existence of Ray Chapman, there's a certain, I guess, attraction for people of, you know, manly men taking things into their own hands. But as you said, in the end, there are broken bones, there are concussions, there are Tony Conigliaros with baseballs in their eyes and never being the same. There are real consequences to this.
Yeah, and if you want to bring it back to the start of the show and why can't we have nice things, alpha male BS. And that's what this is. I'm the big man here.
No,
if you got to say it, you're not.
No. No, as Irving Thalberg, the great movie producer, who was anything but was a big man, but not in stature or in health, said, credit you give yourself is credit not worth having.
Congratulations, Hunter Strickland. You really showed us all something today. Wonderful.
You're our infinite inning man of the week. Stop by Central New Jersey. We'll buy you a cheeseburger. I don't know. Jesse, thank you for doing this, wading into the various controversies of the day, despite technical difficulties and delays that we've had. And we'll look forward to having you back when your turn in the rotation pops up again.
Thank you.
Holy priceless collection of Etruscan snoods, Batman. We've made it barely, but barely to the end of episode 6. I thank you for sticking around. You can follow Jesse Spector at Jesse Spector on Twitter. Some of us are lucky enough to have a name that's not as common as Joe Smith. And that's why you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Unfortunately, sexy Stephen Goldman would have violated truth in advertising laws. Similarly to Jesse, that is, you can follow John Heyman at John Heyman. Everybody's got it so easy. And you can read us all at FanRag. You can send me your comments at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And for gosh sake, subscribe, rate us on iTunes, tell your friends, tell your mama, tell your papa, our love's gonna grow. Ooh-wah, ooh-wah. I really do appreciate it because the more people that listen, the more are hearing us. Don't you love a tautology? I do. We don't have a sponsor as yet, but I understand we're in intensive negotiations with a company that rented video cassettes out of storefronts. Block something or other. Until that works out, we are brought to you by the number 30. Our producer is Zombie Snooks Dowd. He's pretty angry and he's threatening to take my brain and not quite throw it all the way to first base. Our theme song, which you've heard throughout this episode and in fact are hearing now, was co-written by myself and Rick Mooring. He's a long-distance runner now, and he'll be sending photos back to NASA as soon as he reaches Jupiter. We also had a quick snippet of Town Crier, the last song on Elvis Costello's classic album Imperial Bedroom, and if you haven't listened to that one yet, give it a shot. Let me know what you think at the email address I just mentioned. I bet you're going to thank me. Well, if the sun doesn't freeze at a time when Davy Crockett's not around to thaw it with a little bear grease and a swift kick, I'll be back next week with David Roth, and we'll have more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.